Resources Committee to order. The date is February the 4th, 2010. It's 3:35. We do have a quorum to conduct business consisting of our Senate President Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator Wagner, and Senator French, and myself, McGuire. We have one item today on the agenda, and that's an update by the administration on ACES, Alaska's Clear and Equitable Share, and its effect on oil and gas investment. And so without further ado, Commissioner Galvin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With me today is Deputy Commissioner Marcia Davis, and we will be presenting to you both the issues associated with ACES, kind of giving you a little bit of a review. And looking around this room, none of you need the review, but perhaps the folks at home, about the structure of the tax system, how it works, and the state's participation in investment decisions. And then I'm going to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Davis to talk in more detail about the ACES status report and some of the data that was generated to look at the question of what impact ACES may be having on the investment climate. So with that, the overall structure is going to be broken into those two major parts. The portion with regard to the ACES report is also going to look at such things as drilling activity, employment numbers, and such. And you can, no pun intended, drill into those when we get there. So starting off, the overview, I wanted to start things at a fairly high level just to remind us all about the structure of ACES, what it's intended to accomplish in terms of its basic, just the way that the tax is calculated, and how that may play into the question of its impact on the investment climate. So we start off just looking at where does ACES derive the ultimate calculation of what's going to be due? And we talk about the term production tax value. And this is really at the heart of what the production tax calculation is based upon. It is what some people might call a wellhead price plus lease expenditures. You're looking at the sales price of our oil down in the market, subtracting the cost to get it there, both the tankers and the pipeline. And then under this production tax, it's a net-based tax, profit-based tax, we also allow them to subtract the cost to produce the gas or the oil. It's the operating and capital expenditures associated with producing that oil that they deduct from their revenue in order to generate the production tax value. And so when we think about production tax value in the subsequent slides, remember there's two different moving parts that are going to drive that, the price and the expenditures. And both of those will affect what that production tax value is in the calculation.
Senator French.
And just so folks at home are reading this correctly, the word you want to insert on that top line is minus.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, you put a minus in there.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, all right.
Somehow
just
dropped out in,
that's
the,
okay,
in the editing.
It got minused.
it got minused, right. Subtracted.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So the other two terms that we're going to be looking at is the base tax rate, which under ACES is 25%. On the production tax value. And then we will be talking about the progressive surcharge rate. And just as a reminder, this is the additional tax rate that is added to the 25% based upon that production tax value. When the profit on a barrel goes above $30, then there's going to be an increase in the tax rate from a $30 profit up to a $92.50 profit. It will go up 0.4% per dollar of additional production tax value. Once it gets above $92.50, which is the break point where you get to a 50% total tax rate between the base tax and the progressive, it will then increase at a 0.1% per dollar up to $342.50 of profit, which brings you up to a 75% total tax rate.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator French.
Thank you. And just while we're doing this overview, maybe you can just remind us about where the production tax value kicks in at a price per barrel of oil. That is, you've got to take, you know, it's not, yeah, market price today is, say, $75. But where does the production tax actually start to take a bite?
It's going to be, Senator French, to the chair, it's going to be different for different taxpayers, because each taxpayer is going to have a different amount of basically the costs associated with producing their oil, and that will be both operating and capital expenditures. If they have a particular new development project, they may be expending a significant amount of money during those years, and they get to immediately deduct it from their production tax value. On average, across the North Slope, we generally use somewhere between $25, $26, $27 to represent the per barrel aggregate of transportation and lease expenditures. That's sort of our ballpark for folks to think about. And so, back to your question, that would mean that the market price, West Coast ANS price, would need to be approximately $56, $57 before we would be kicking into a progressivity situation.
Senator French.
That's for progressivity, but just for the basic tax, what I just heard you say is across the North Slope, the first $25 to $27 per barrel escapes production tax.
That's correct.
Free of tax whatsoever. And then between, say, 25 and 50, you've got the 25%, and then after 50, you start paying progressivity.
And just to be absolutely precise, there is a minimum tax that acts as a floor, but recognizing that it is a sliding scale that slides downward as the price goes downward. And so it's sort of a sliding floor as the price goes down. And it's a fairly minimal level of a floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So just walking through in a very high-level fashion, for those who want more detail on this type of calculation, in Senate Finance, we go through a much more rigorous analysis of the different components in number form. But just in sort of the big picture, we talked about the production tax value being that net amount. You multiply that times the base tax rate, 25%, to get the base tax. You multiply that production tax value against the progressive surcharge rate, and you get the progressive surcharge on top of that. Those two combined to bring in your pre-credit tax bill, what you owe if you didn't have any credits to apply. And then you deduct your credits. Credits are in multiple forms, and we'll talk about that in a moment, and come right off dollar for dollar from your tax bill to ultimately end with the production tax that you owe being the net of those two after subtracting out your credits. If it turns out that after subtracting your credits, you end up in the negative, in other words, your credits wipe out your tax bill, or perhaps you don't have any production at all and you start with a zero in terms of your tax bill, and you end up where you have credits that you aren't able to apply against your taxes, then there are mechanisms to where you can submit those to the state, and the state will basically pay you dollar for dollar on those credits, or you can transfer those to another taxpayer. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a moment. So those credits are in multiple forms, and this is, again, very high-level look at it, but we've got a $12 million off the top credit for small producers, ones who have those minimal production levels, who are expending money in the state. There's a across the board 20% credit on all capital expenditures. So those development costs, things where you're putting in major equipment, those are going to qualify for 20% credit. So that comes right off your tax bill. For certain expenditures that are outside of the current operating areas, you could qualify for what's referred to as an exploration incentive credit. Those range from 30% to 40% of your costs for, again, for certain expenditures outside of the current operating areas. And then if you don't have any production and you're incurring operating and capital costs that result in basically a negative value for your production tax value, you're subtracting off and you're getting to a negative, then you apply that 25% tax rate and you end up with a loss carry forward that you can bring forward as a credit in future years. So to be able to demonstrate this, we've provided a couple, again, large snapshots of what the tax experience would be for a new entrant or a existing producer as it relates to the application of credits, just so you can kind of see how the state participates in those investment factors. So if we start off with what we refer to as a new entrant. So this is a company that basically doesn't have any production in the state at this time, and they're coming into Alaska looking primarily at exploration opportunities. And let's say that they have an exploration project that's going to require a $200 million investment. Depending upon the location of that exploration activity, they will receive a capital credit in the amount of between 20%, maybe 30%, maybe 40% on those expenditures. So it's to them, out of their $200 million investment, that is worth $40 to $80 million that they will get back from the state. In addition, as I mentioned, they will also likely incur a tax loss, which at the tax rate of base tax rate of 25% will result in an additional credit on that loss of up to of then bringing them to $50 million on that particular component. So between these two, they're going to qualify for credits on that $200 million investment of between $90 and $130 million. They can either submit that to the state, and under certain circumstances, they'll be able to get cash back from the state for that credit. Or they can find a taxpayer who's willing to buy that credit from them. And the person who earned the credit will try to get their most value for that, but they'll sell it at something less than dollar for dollar. But at the end of the transaction, that the person who acquired the credit certificate will then apply that against their taxes, which will reduce the state's revenue dollar for dollar. We will be out the full $90 to $130 million.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator French.
I mean, it looks to me like, I mean, just the math is such that on a new entrant, a $200 million, someone who comes to the state spends $200 million, they're going to get back almost half their money. It's like a 50% off sale through the state for their investment directly back to them. Is that about right?
They'll get back between 45 and perhaps 65% of their investment costs.
And that's dollars back to their treasury. They've spent this money to drill a big project or to skid in gear, and now they're going to get, a year later, half of their money back or more.
Under the right circumstances, and we'll talk as we get into, probably not today, but in future discussions, this session, I would imagine, we're going to talk about some of the provisions that may hinder that transaction. But in concept, that's what they would earn.
Thank you.
And Senator Wilikowski and Huggins have joined us some time ago.
And so either way, whether they try to get the cash back from the state or they transfer it to another taxpayer, the state pays the $90 to $130 million for the exploration activity, the $200 million exploration activity, and the state paying the remainder. So just to put a finer point on that, recognizing that exploration itself is a risky venture. You don't know whether you're going to succeed or not, whether that investment is going to result in a project that actually produces revenue for you. If the exploration effort fails, it doesn't find sufficient quantities of oil, then the state is still out the money. We're not going to ask for that money back. So it's important to note that the state, in addition to just paying the money, we also bear the risk associated with failure, the failure leg of that exploration project, as does the actual investor. So just turning it around to an incumbent producer, it varies slightly from the experience of the new entrant, because they have an existing tax base that they're paying on. But let's imagine a situation where an incumbent existing producer has a development project that is going to cost $200 million to get up and going. So again, like the explorer, the capital credit associated with that investment will earn a 20% credit, so $40 million right off. We assume that it's within the existing field, so they're not eligible for the exploration incentive credit program, so it'll be at 20%, not above that. And then by reducing their production tax value by the amount of the capital expenditure, that $200 million, they reduce their taxes by the tax rate coming off of that reduction in the production tax value. So basically what that means is they get $200 million times 25%, $50 million worth of reduction in their taxes. And then the second part to note is that we noted earlier that the production tax value will establish what their progressivity surcharge is going to be. The higher their production tax value, the higher they slide up that scale. By making this $200 million investment and having it immediately reduce their production tax value, they slide back down that scale. So their tax rate that will apply to all of their production is reduced, and that provides a benefit to them. And also that $200 million gets multiplied times that progressivity surcharge as well, the reduced one. And so both those components will add value to them. That will be at least the amount of the $200 million times the progressivity surcharge. So combined, the state will provide a immediate tax benefit of at least 45% of the cost of that development investment.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator French.
Assuming oil prices are over $25, is that right? I mean, assuming they're paying a production tax.
Well, even if they weren't paying the production tax, they still would get to reduce, and they would still get the credit.
Right.
And they'd still be able to reduce their production tax value. And so if that brought them down below the 27, then it's still going to provide them with a similar economic benefit.
Just a follow-up, though. I mean, I thought we established a few slides back that you don't pay any production tax until prices for most producers, most incumbent producers, get above $25 to $27 a barrel.
That's correct. But if they are, if they're below that, if they...
So if oil prices are at $25 and you're not paying any production tax, then the investment shouldn't get you any additional benefit other than the credit, or am I missing something?
You would then have...
You get the credit.
Reducing it,
right?
By reducing your production tax, you'd be reducing your production tax value even greater than the 20. For here's where it becomes important to follow the fact that the $27 or $25 that we talked about was our average.
Right.
For an individual taxpayer, if they were otherwise at the average and they added a $200 million
expenditure,
their number for deductions would be greater than $25 per barrel. They would then go into the negative. And the tax rate multiplied by that negative becomes a loss carry forward for a credit subsequent.
So they may not get it this year, but you're saying they'll get it in the future. It's something they can carry forward.
Correct.
I see.
They get that value.
Okay. Thank you.
So at in total, with a existing producer with a new development expenditure, the state will pay at least $90 million, more likely more than that at today's oil prices, and will be a significant participant in that initial investment. Again, if the development fails, it doesn't provide the production that was expected, the state bears that risk as well. We don't get that money back. And so just noting that the risk component of this investment is also borne by the state, that we're putting that money up regardless of the outcome. So just the key points in the demonstration, there is no difference in the cash flow to the state whether that investment was made by a producer, existing producer, or a new entrant. Either way, we're going to be out the money, whether it's in the form of reduced initial revenue or in the form of a payment of a tax certificate, a credit certificate. The state is bearing the risk on that investment. And by taking on some of the risk and participating in reducing the initial investment hurdle for these companies, they're putting up basically half the cost of getting the same potential reward. The state is making the investment more attractive than it would otherwise be. And so just to kind of cap the whole thing, recognizing that across the board, the state is providing more than 50% of the cost of all new investment, whether it be exploration or development. The state's the largest investor in exploration and new development in the state under this system. And then finally, I wanted to throw this slide up. This is part of the ACES report that generally Marcia's going to go through, but it provides a reflection on some of the confusion that happens in the public rhetoric associated with ACES, because there are many different ways of describing a tax rate that can be both informative and sometimes can cause confusion and to a certain extent misrepresentation when you try to compare those outside to other jurisdictions. And so what people will hear in the discussion of the production tax are things such as an effective tax rate or a marginal tax rate. And a lot of what gets folks' attention is when you talk about big numbers and you talk about that at certain price points, the marginal tax rate associated with the ACES system goes up to almost 90%. That seems like an incredibly high number. Well, let's talk about what that means and what's actually happening at that particular point. What most people think about when you talk about tax rate, they just talk about the fact that it goes from 25%, climbs through progressivity up to 50%, and then slides out to potentially up to 75%. That's what's referred to as your nominal tax rate, sort of the number that is in the statute. When you look at the effect on the bottom line and you say, okay, at X price, I'm going to be bringing in this much revenue and I'm going to pay this much tax, what percent of my revenue am I going to have to pay in tax? That's what's referred to as the effective tax rate. That's the one that we kind of think of mostly for ourselves in terms of our exposure to the federal government or others. We think of the effective tax rate, the amount that actually comes out of our pocket associated with an amount of revenue or income that we would have. The term marginal tax rate is a much different calculation. It's saying that as the price of oil goes up a dollar, the additional revenue associated with that $1 increase, how much of that increase is going to go to pay taxes? And because of the way that the progressivity works, that is what goes up fairly steeply. Yeah. And you can see from this diagram. What that also means is the inverse, which means that as that number goes up, every dollar that you spend will reduce your taxes by the same percentage. So when people talk about, you know, at certain levels, and this is just, you know, when we get out to where our production tax value is in that $92.50. So on average, somewhere when you get around $120 a barrel market price, we get to this peak. And at that particular point, we get out to that 90%, and then we drop off immediately. It's just the fact that the math works this way. At that point in time, every dollar that is spent by a company reduces their taxes by 90 cents or so. So when you think about, you know, what's the tax rate that they're paying, it's not 90%. At that same point, you can see from this chart that they're paying somewhere less than 40% in actual tax rate. But it does mean that their incentive for investing, the one thing they can control, the price. So they can't control the effect that may have. But if they spend money at that point, it's going to have a significant impact on their tax bill, which under the charts that I showed you earlier, when I said at certain that the state participates, you know, at least 45%, at these rates, the state's participating upwards of 90%. So that's why it's important to note those things, but not to get confused when people talk about these numbers, and recognizing that there's a difference between that marginal tax rate and the effective tax rate and its effect on the behavior of the companies. So, Madam Chair, with that, we're going to now transition into a discussion of some of the data that came out of the ACES status report and provide a picture of what at least the reports the Department of Revenue has looked at show. And Marcia Davis will be taking it from there.
Thank you, Commissioner. Let me just go ahead here and allow members to jump in. Thank you for your presentation, Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could we just go back one slide, because that that tax rate thing is something, you know, you hear a lot about on radio. You hear about a lot of, you know, you just hear a lot of talk about it. And I think it's just important for folks to understand that, you know, just pick a healthy number, say $100 a barrel. The effective tax rate is less than 30%. It looks like it's about 28 or 29%, something like that.
That's correct.
And that's again, the total revenue that the particular company's taking in divided by the total tax paid.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stedman.
If I could, I know this is a little bit off track, but I think one of the things we're going to look at here in coming attractions is that marginal decision that the companies make to continue a particular investment, and what impact these different tax rates or the marginal tax rate may or may not have on that. There's been some concern expressed that the marginal rate puts them at a disadvantage competing against other locations within the company for capital. Mm-hmm. So we'll kind of explore that, but it is an area I think we need to take a look at and become more comfortable with.
Yeah, and on that point, I think that's the concern that I've heard too, is that the ability to really profit at the high end for some producers ends up being the driving force behind making decisions about where to put new investment. And so I think, you know, this is great, and as we continue to look at it, trying to understand how companies make decisions helps us as well, because we can look at this and think it makes sense mathematically that if they just invest more, they're going to be at a 28 or 29% rate. But clearly we know that it doesn't work exactly like that. Different drivers go into those decisions.
That's right. And part of, I mean, when you look at a chart like this, and we talk about the effect that a marginal tax rate might have on those investment decisions, you have to, you know, recognize that there is a lag time between a decision and when it's actually implemented and when the expenditures are made. And that's, I think, the question that we're facing is, from a company's perspective, if they knew that when they actually are spending the dollars, they're going to be up here in the $100, $110 price range. Even though the progressivity is high, it also would mean that they would have the state paying the bulk of the expenditure. I mean, they would be reducing their existing taxes by that amount to make that investment decision, you know, perhaps more favorable. Their worst case situation is that they make the expenditure when the prices are down here, but the production comes in when the prices are up at the top, and then they pay the higher effective tax rate, because this is what the effective tax rate is what they're going to pay, and they're going to basically make the expenditure at the low end, get the lower value from the state's participation, but end up paying when the prices are up. And I think that's part of the conversation that Senator Stedman may be referring to.
Absolutely. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, my recollection of the many months of debate that we had on this was that we looked at this, and this was really a conscious decision made by the administration and the legislature, because what we were seeing was the oil companies making billions and billions of dollars in profit in Alaska and not reinvesting that money in Alaska, even though we had fairly low tax rates. In many cases, under ELF, we had many fields that had 0% severance tax rates. And yet we didn't see the investment. We saw the companies making billions and taking that money and shipping it out of state. And so my recollection of the reason we structured ACES the way we did was to encourage companies to reinvest that money in Alaska. If prices are high and they're making very high profits, then my recollection is we set up this structure so that it would really encourage them to reinvest in Alaska rather than taking that money outside of Alaska and investing in other states and other countries. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's an accurate depiction of the way this system is intended to work. It's intended to basically tax the money that's taken out of the state at a much higher rate than the money that is earned but invested back in Alaska that gets a significant tax break.
And I'll just ask you the question to either one of you, and maybe you'll get into this, Marcia. I mean, did we make a good policy call? And based on your data that you've analyzed, should we not have made the call that we made? I guess if you can answer that question now, I'd like to hear it, or if you're getting into that soon, I'd like to hear that as well.
I think what we could do is have Marcia go through what she has, and then we can talk about sort of conclusions at the end, and that way we can have the information in front of us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, my name is Marcia Davis, and I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Revenue. What I'll be covering today is the information that was developed by the Department of Revenue's Econ Research Group, and we're going to cover briefly the revenue comparisons under what would have been under the various different production tax setups that we've had, ELF, PPT, and ACES. We're going to look at lease expenditures over the last historical and prospective, you know, projected time periods. We're going to look at standard deduction experience. That was one element of ACES. The oil and gas employment figures and drilling activity levels. The ACES status report we released on January 14th, 2010, this year. It was prepared, we began preparing it in late summer, early fall, at the request of Commissioner Galvin, who felt that with roughly 2 years under our belt, we needed to take a look at it, and certainly there were enough inquiries and folks asking, is ACES working the way it should work? So we wanted to gather as much data as we could from which the policy makers could make judgments and fine-tune or leave as is, whatever was their ultimate choice. In addition, while we were working on the ACES report, we began receiving inquiries from various legislators in the form of letters asking precisely the same questions that Commissioner Galvin was asking us. So we tried to roll in as much information as we could into ACES report in hopes of addressing as many of the questions that the legislators had, as well as Commissioner Galvin. To do our report, we looked at confidential taxpayer data, and this consisted of their tax returns, which were both the monthly returns as well as the final annual returns. Those had a certain level of detail that enabled us to look at what expenditures were being
spent on, whether they were capital, OPEX, and of capital, what type of capital cost, et cetera. We also, for a forecast look, under ACES, were given the right to request from operators information about what they were seeing ahead in the next year, 2 or 3 years, 4 years, so that we could get a window on where they were going, where they thought they were going, at least, in terms of where they saw their expenditures and developments. In addition, we requested information from the State Department of Labor regarding employment statistics. We inquired of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, who are the agency that essentially issue the well permits and track completion reports, et cetera, throughout the state on oil and gas wells. And finally, we also inquired of information from Department of Natural Resources. So first, looking at the most obvious question and the most constant question we were getting was, how does revenue to the state under, you know, as a production tax compare under ACES versus PPT versus ELF? And so what you'll see here is obviously starting with 2007, 8, 9, and 10 forward, these were years governed by ELF, by ACES, but what if PPT were in place? What if ELF were in place? And you'll see that in each of these years, 7, 8, 9, and 10, ACES did in fact generate a larger amount of state revenue under the production tax structure. And one thing I'll point out, it's not in a slide here, but what we were able to deduce from this information is that essentially ACES outperforms the prior system, ELF, at about $51 per barrel West Coast price. So once West Coast price hits $51, ACES outperforms ELF. And the corollary would be true that ELF would outperform ACES under $51 on the West Coast. And I just want to point out for the revenue projections for 2010, those are based on our oil price forecasts that were issued in 2009 fall. So that represents a forecasted oil price of $66.93 per barrel. Because ACES is a net tax, obviously what matters is once you have your revenue and you know your price and your volumes of oil sold, you have to ask, what are the lease expenditures that are being deducted? And lease expenditures are made up of two categories of expenses. You have capital expenses, which tend to be your hard cost, things that you spend money on that hang around. They endure. They're considered durable goods, and they have a life. And in the IRS world, you're depreciating those types of assets. Operating expenditures tend to be your upkeep, your services, labor, things that you have to do over and over again. They're just things that you're going to repeat, like your energy bill and rent, et cetera. Maybe not your rent. I won't go that far.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator French.
Thank you. Do we have data going back before 2007?
We have some data for CapEx and some data for OPEX, and I'll show you that in the next two slides.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, one thing I want to point out, too, the operating expenditures that are listed on this chart, you'll note there the light color, and you'll see that they are generally increasing in trend as you go from 07, 08 was a little lower, 09 it's going back up, 10 it's up, and 11 it's up. And these are what we call actual capital. Actually, those are the actual capital expenditures. The OPEX, I wanted to point out, is not the standard deduction for those earlier years, 07, 08, 09. What we've done is we actually went in and used what taxpayers reported were their actual OPEX. So these are real numbers, as opposed to they haven't been muted by the standard deduction.
Marcia, on that point, when you list capital expenditures, there's been this discussion about repairs to existing infrastructure versus new infrastructure. Is there any delineation between the two in your data?
I'll jump ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. It's no problem. We did get exactly that question, Chairman McGuire. And the question was, are we seeing CapEx and OPEX go up because of the increased maintenance at the slope? And so we did feather out the details on the expenditures from the data that we had, and what we did is, in a conservative manner, we tried to identify things that were clearly tied to wells, drilling, workovers, coiled tube drilling, and costs that were directly associated with anything that would cause production to be increased or introduced, new production, old production, anything associated with production. And we isolated those in a bucket for both the CapEx and the OpEx type costs. And then we considered everything else other, which would be maintenance or, you know, things that people think of as perhaps you would do anyway if you were on a field and it was aging and you were trying to replace it. And what we found is that both categories of production-related and maintenance-related were going up. So we found that there was an increase in both categories of expenditures. So CapEx and OpEx were both increasing in the production-related areas.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That's helpful information to know, because I've heard that argument many times. And do you break that down? Do you have somewhere, because I see you have OpEx, you have CapEx. I don't see a bar for...
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we have not represented that, segregated it out in that fashion, in part because it is confidential taxpayer information. We can aggregate it, but it varies by unit. And so we can display some unit information where there's at least three owners, but we can't display other unit information where there are less than three owners, so it would be an incomplete portrait.
So when we're looking at this bar graph here, this is CapEx and OpEx, but not including maintenance costs.
No, excuse me, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this includes maintenance and production. This is everything rolled up.
Here, and Senator Wilkowski was in a dialogue with Marcia.
Yeah, Marcia. So just looking at this chart that you have here with the bar graphs, so maintenance costs is included in these charts?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, yes, it is.
And can you give us a rough estimation of how much of, and is it including capital, and if so, how much roughly is maintenance?
Well, one of our challenges is that we only have data from the tax returns. And so in terms of looking, we won't have a forecast for instance, fiscal year 10 and 11 are still forward-looking. We don't have actual returns yet for those. So what we actually have is going to be a partial year for 07. We'll have all of 08, and we'll have the monthly returns for 09, but we don't have yet the final returns filed until March of 2010 for a good portion of that. So. We did the calculation to see the trends by pulling the data for those time periods, but we haven't done a chart yet of that. Okay. But, you know, we could attempt to try to do something that would break those out. But again, it would be, the problem is once you start to parse the data, we'll have better data as we get a few more years under our belt.
Thank you, Marcia. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just trying to remember, for a long time, I mean, we're sort of talking about this these increased maintenance costs, but what a lot of folks mean when they say that are really the costs that BP incurred as a result of the fact they didn't maintain their flow lines for a long time, and suddenly they had oil spills, and there was huge amounts of money having to be spent to fix that.
Senator French, through the chair, it certainly was the start of it, but under ACEs, costs that are associated with gross negligence or associated with a spill, et cetera, are not allowed to be deducted. However, having had those experiences, certainly an operator learns, you know, what needs to be done, and so one would expect there to be an increase in maintenance cost after such incidents. So I think it's more targeting that latter category that we're looking at, and people are concerned that you see an escalation of proactive maintenance activity.
Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Point Thompson, is it a significant piece of these numbers?
Point Thompson, in terms of North Slope expenditures, on the forecast side, beginning, say, in fiscal year, small part of 09, and into 10 and 11, we've said Point Thompson, Uruk, Nakayachuk, there are some new developments that clearly are large expenditures that are a portion of this. Yes, sir.
But capital expenditures, as I recall, Exxon talked about how expensive it was to be able to drill wells, and the overall cost and their investment up front was significant. So I don't know, you know, whether it's a little bit or a big chunk of what's listed here.
I'd have to go back and check with my people whether I can speak with reference to Point Thompson alone because of the confidentiality provisions. Yeah.
I just maybe little, big, small.
It certainly material. It's material, and I can say that I know that in our revenue source book, we identified Point Thompson, Nakayachuk, and Uruk as a significant chunk of the capital expenses that we're going to be seeing into the future.
Thank you.
Senator Willikowski had previously asked if we had historical information so that we could look back as well as look forward.
Oh. And I'm very sympathetic to the feeling that you're not getting the full story, and we struggle sometimes with what we can reveal and what we can't. What I would, offer is that while we may not be able to provide you with certain information, the taxpayer themselves could, and if you perhaps were able to get any sort of a cost estimate from Exxon as an operator, then you can compare it to the overall and get a sense from an annual basis how it stacks up in terms of the percentage.
Right. I just want to make sure that we're not drawing a conclusion that doesn't paint the picture of actually what's happened, because the order of magnitude of some locations and the money that's involved in the activity versus what's not happening in some other places being masked.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, that is absolutely correct. And all we can do is look at the aggregate, the roll-up, what that tells us with respect to specific locations. We need to be very careful in drawing conclusions about, you know, what is or is not happening as far as trends. And all we can do is look at kind of the overall trends, but ask ourselves what are the pieces that make it up, and what we try to do when we, for instance, do our forecasting. We do precisely what you're doing, which is look at each individual field and ask ourselves, what is the production that will come from that field over time? What are the expenses that will come from that field over time? So that we're getting a very granular, built-up level of what is actually our future, so that we don't delude ourselves into thinking, gosh, here's some projects that are really going gangbusters, and now suddenly they stop, and we weren't noticing that other fields had stopped growing, for instance, or stopped expending. So we do have to look at it granularly, and we do that for our forecast. When we look ahead and say how much, and that is where our forward look comes from that buildup of data from all of the different owners.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And the other one is extrapolation of what you're showing for activity and the dollars involved, and then you look to the extrapolation of what the production is, in this case, oil. If you cross that, because I mean that's our ultimate goal. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter about what to expend. Mm-hmm. It's about the results.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be interested in if you see some picture evolving out of that activity, because that's our goal. At least that's my goal.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, that's precisely why we were trying to look at which of the expenditures were associated with what we would call production adds, essentially what is actually growing production or adding production and ensuring that that's coming in, because clearly that's a key focus.
And that's going to be someplace in the slide?
That is essentially, it was sort of the backside of the question about are these costs all maintenance or not? And so what we were able to find out is no, they aren't. The growth in expenditures are not just about maintenance. They're also about production adds, and we're seeing those expenditures increase as well.
Thank you.
Marcia, if I could just ask, too, for the next time we talk about this, I'd be interested to see, and I understand that you have fiduciary obligations and things you can't reveal, but for the Natoyachuk and the Ugric and the Point Thompson, I'd like to see a better breakdown, mm-hmm. because two of those fields have royalty reductions that were put into place, Natoyachuk and Ugric. And so if capital investment is being made in those fields, then it's certainly not indicative of any kind of an ACES pattern, but rather might actually be indicative of what we've done to incentivize development and how it might work. Mm-hmm. So my ask is, however you can best do that, I'd like to see a better, as following on Senator Huggins, his line of questioning, I'd like to see a better breakdown in terms of where those investments are being made.
And Madam Chairman, I'd just like to comment on the comparison of royalty relief to what the production tax provides in terms of incentive, just in the sense of scale. With Natoyachuk, for example, the royalty relief that's provided is actually for both of them, because royalty is a smaller percentage of the overall take, the amount of relief that you might provide is going to provide a incentive that is significantly smaller than what's provided through what I described earlier in terms of the state's participation via the production tax. And so I just want to make sure that there isn't any confusion there, that there is a significant distinction in terms of scale of incentive between what could be provided under royalty relief versus what is provided under the production tax. But to the question, I think it's a valid question in terms of providing you a picture of how much individual projects, maybe as grouped, whatever we can do in a public release, to show how much is going towards that when we show a capital expenditure level versus what, you know, how that trends if those projects drop off.
Yeah, and on that point, Commissioner, thank you. Yes, so distinction between severance tax relief and royalty relief, but I think in the end what we're trying to figure out is, as Senator Huggins said, is, you know, we want to make exploration work. We're an oil and gas state. It's our lifeline economically. There's got to be a healthy balance between the state's take and industry's take, and there are different levers and buttons that you can push and pull: property, severance, royalty, all those things. But if in the end we understand where the investments are being made and which levers have been pushed and pulled in which direction, I think it helps us make a more accurate assessment, you know, as we go into these discussions.
And just the power of handheld communication. Senator Huggins, what I can tell you is, with regard to the Point Thompson, it's not, let's just say that it's less than a quarter of the overall capital expenditure from what we're reporting, just to bracket it. It's not like a disproportionate amount.
Again, looking at the historical trends, we can do operating costs on a historical basis, but only looking at Prudhoe Bay, because as you recall, under the prior tax systems, we weren't net tax. Therefore, you know, we didn't really gather data relating to OPEX or CAPEX. But because of the discussions that took place relative to the Stranded Gas Development Act et cetera. The state was privy to some historical costs associated with Prudhoe. So therefore, we were able, and I guess I shouldn't say that. I guess it wasn't the Stranded Gas Development Act data. It was the TIE credit data that gave us some of these costs as well. So anyway, through various, not operating. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. It must have been this Stranded Gas Act then. We legally and properly acquired some data relating to Prudhoe Bay. And so we were able to keep it in context, and again, so that we weren't mixing apples and oranges, here's a snapshot of Prudhoe Bay, one of the largest contributors to the state revenue. And you can track the OPEX as reported across that range of time period. And you'll see that it is, in fact, increasing over time. And so then the next question is, well, is this represent an increase in just cost per unit? So in other words, it's not really more activity, it's just simply more unit cost, or does this actually represent an increase in activity? And the answer would be it's a combination of both. Clearly, there have been increases in the unit costs of getting things done. Labor services, et cetera, have gone up on a per unit basis. But we also see an increase in activity as well.
And then, of course, it has to be noted on that same slide that the first drop, meaningful drop you see, is between 2009 and 2010.
That is correct, Chairman McGuire. And the reason we are forecast, and that's a forecasted drop, and the reason we're forecasting a drop is because we're looking at global markers, indexes for operating expenditures. We're seeing those coming down. We're also looking at our data and looking at what the costs are that we're able to extract and see that those unit costs are starting to come down. In addition, because essentially the oil price has come down from its peak in the end of 2008, we find that unit costs of goods tend to come down and trail oil price by about a year to a year and a half. So we're right in that zone where we're starting to see the costs of services, et cetera, start to match or at least catch up to the decrease in oil price that happened when it ran up over the 08 time period.
Yeah, thank you. And just trying to understand this chart. This does this chart indicate, is this a good thing, or is this meaning that overall costs have gone down, or does this mean that the price of materials, the price of labor has gone down, and therefore the operating costs per barrel have gone down?
Well, if we hadn't looked under the skin and just seen it, you wouldn't necessarily know whether it was a good or a bad thing. But again, because we've looked under the skin and been able to verify this is not just simply an increase in the cost of goods and services, but rather it is reflecting an increase in activity. So there's more things are being done, which is why we're seeing more reported OPEX. It is a good thing in the sense that we are seeing a healthy trend as far as activity level.
I think, but maybe the question goes to the 2010 trend.
Right, exactly.
I'm sorry.
If it used to cost in 09 $11.80 per barrel, and now it's costing $9 a barrel, as a producer, I'm thinking that's probably a good thing. My labor costs have gone down.
Yes.
My material costs have gone down. So that's the sense that I'm asking at. But am I misinterpreting this?
No, Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, this actually is a good reflection that the industry has been able to push back and get the service industry to respond by lowering their costs because their oil prices come down. Because their revenues have come down, now we're starting to see the OPEX associated with that production come down as well. So it gets them back in a zone, a healthy zone.
However, you did indicate that there was a combination of factors. That was part of the onion peeling.
Yes.
So if it works one way, it's got to work the other way.
Absolutely.
If it works positively in the upward, that means that there is a direct correlation between both the unit cost and activity. Mm-hmm. So if it's working in the decrease, then by definition it would be it's a reduction in cost but a reduction in activity.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, yes. I mean, obviously we have companies.
Senator McGuire, through yourself.
Chairman McGuire. I mean, we obviously have gathered data that's publicly available about what some of the major companies are doing. They all are cutting back on expenditures because of the global recession. And then the only question is how much and where. And so what we're finding is, yes, some of this may be reflection of some ratcheting back of expenditures at a corporate center level, plus the lower expenditure of unit costs.
Yeah, just in general, looking at this chart and maybe answering Senator Wilikowski's question, is this a good or a bad thing? The escalation of per unit cost is not a good thing for us or for the producers. It means that it costs more to produce one barrel of oil out of Prudhoe Bay, which makes it less profitable and ultimately causes us issues down the road. The question I think that Marcia was answering initially was whether this indicates something has happened with regard to ACES or the incentive that ACES created back in 2007. And what we've seen is that with regard to operating expenditures in particular, this doesn't seem to be driven by a investment incentive decision-making methodology necessarily, you know, in terms of what we described earlier. The operating expenditures are kind of what you get for what you have to do. And as she indicated, most of this is driven by what we saw as a steep escalation in just across the board oil and gas sector costs. And then the drop-off just follows along with what we see. And actually, the next slide, I think, will show it in particular, that we see just across the oil and gas sector worldwide this same escalation and then a peak in 2009 and then a drop-off. That seems to mirror what we experienced here in Alaska as well and doesn't seem to be reflective of ACES either way.
Pay attention to these charts. They end up defining climate change, wars, and
all that. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I recall we were using the term lifting cost. And is lifting cost interchangeable operating expenditures? Or could you help me out if we use that? What would, I guess, to say it another way, we were throwing around $20, $22 a barrel was the lifting cost. Mm-hmm. What's the difference between lifting costs and operating expenditures?
I would say they're probably pretty interchangeable in the sense that I would say that lifting costs are a component of operating costs. There may be other aspects of operating costs that would be in addition to what are generally fall in the category of lifting costs. But
these numbers are, Madam Chair, that these numbers are less than half the number that we were using. We're accepting $20, $22.
Okay, and that's that, so here's the other thing that remember. We have a granularity here with Prudhoe Bay as opposed to the whole North Slope. And the lifting costs associated with the whole North Slope are going to be different than those that are isolated for just Prudhoe Bay. Prudhoe Bay is probably the more efficient because of its size and the economies of scale than what you'll find elsewhere on the North Slope. And so that probably is a big factor in the difference between the general term that's used and what we can show here. And another thing, just because you guys all have a history of moving through this, under ACES, there's a provision that allows us to show you the information for Prudhoe Bay that previously the Department of Revenue wouldn't have been able to show you, Prudhoe Bay specific. And so that may also be one of the reasons why you may not have seen this type of slide before that's specific to Prudhoe Bay.
So, but I think it's important for us if Prudhoe Bay is granular, to use your term, well, you know, what are the non-granular operating locations? What are they? And what's the number? Is it a huge difference? About the same? You don't have to answer that now. Just mm-hmm. Whatever the numbers are.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, we can certainly look at the range and provide a range of what we consider to be the OPEX and the CAPEX type charges, you know, costs on a barrel basis. I've worked in the industry for 9 years and I've heard lifting costs used in various ways. So I would hesitate to opine how it was used historically with this body. Looking at the historical trends associated with the capital expenditures, this is something that I think we were able to acquire out of the TIE credit data that was used and presented to the department to obtain tie credits. And what you...
Madam Chairman, if I could just interrupt, because people are going to say tie credits?
What are we talking about? Transitionally.
Yeah, under PPT, when it was passed, there was what was referred to transitional investment expenditure or something like that, credits that were also referred to as a clawback. There's a bunch of other terms for it. But it allowed the companies moving forward to earn credits for the capital expenditures they had made for 5 years in the past. That gave the forward producing companies a rationale to provide the Department of Revenue with numbers for their previous 5 years of capital expenditures. And so that's why we got this little window into the 5 years prior to PPT, because they came in with their claims for their tie credits, so they had to provide us with their 5 years worth of capital spending.
Okay. So we got the data. So we were able to look back. And this, unlike the other, is actually North Slope, more of a North Slope-wide number, not just restricted to Prudhoe. And what you can see from this chart is essentially there was, during the time period when ELF was in place, 01, 02, 03, 04, 05, you've got a dip in capital expenditures. It starts to build coming out of 05. You hit 06, 07, 08, 09. So what we can say is what we're not seeing is a decrease in capital expenditures after the passage of the PPT and the ACES. We can't say that it's because of PPT or ACES, certainly, but we're not seeing a decrement there. And in fact, if you can see, we've got 09 at about the 2.2 billion dollar level for capital expenditure. What I did have, I noticed we had a forecast on the other chart, and so I wanted to at least provide the values of what we're forecasting for these others. And unfortunately, these are calendar year, so our forecast is in fiscal years, but I think you'll see roughly the trend. What we're looking at for the fiscal year 2010 is about 2.5 billion in capital expenditures, so that would take it up to the top of the chart. And then for 2011, we're looking at 2.9 billion, which would take it up another increment on that chart if they were charted here.
Can I ask, Marcia, is that based, the projection, the forward-looking projection in expenditures, is the basis of that the question that you asked in your forms about 3-year projections on the part of the company themselves?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chairman McGuire, yes, we do basically pose the questions to the operators asking for at all the units, all the fields that are in development or explorations, and we ask them to tell us what they're doing over the next 5 years. And we place obviously much more certainty on the coming year and a little less certainty on the following year after that, because obviously no company is bound to their commitment in terms of what they see as their forward plan. Owners can change their plans as they move through the year, but this is our projection based on those reports that we've gotten from operators.
So then what we want to explore too as a committee is why then companies like ConocoPhillips have come forward and said, you know, for the first time in 44 years we won't drill an exploration well, you know. So we've got some real contrasting.
And Chairman McGuire, recall that these are North Slope wide. So again, what we are reporting is a all up, rolled up number for North Slope as far as capital expenditure. So you may have a company that is genuinely, you know, through their corporate direction, been instructed to, you know, restrict capital expenditures for their particular circumstances. Another company may not be similarly positioned and may be increasing their capital expenditure. So what we report is, in terms of the rolled up numbers, these are the numbers we saw historically, and these are the numbers we're seeing based on the aggregation of the reports from the operators.
Good.
In their entirety.
Back on this point too, to the extent that you can, please for us be prepared to come back to the committee and let us know, as I asked in the earlier portion, in these expenditures, as best you can, where they're being made.
Mm-hmm.
If it's in Uguruk, if it's in these other places, we want to know so that you know, again, we're trying to find that balance. I mean, and it strikes me it's a similar thing that we've done with Nanana Basin and Cook Inlet mm-hmm. in natural gas. Mm-hmm. There's historical precedence for this committee to look at each part of the state, each resource individually, and to say, what can we do to incentivize this particular field? So mm-hmm. it's not unique, mm-hmm. You know, and again, we're just trying to sort out from all of the sort of broad brushing statements what's really going on.
Chairman McGuire, that certainly is useful because as Commissioner Galvin did in his introduction on ACEs, we clearly have a perspective on what we call incumbents, folks that are there and have older fields or, you know, have already there and producing. We also have a focus on new explorers, new entrants, new companies coming in. And both groups will incur capital expenditures in the development of their respective projects. So being able to see where these things are coming through will give guidance to the policymakers.
Great. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just making sure I'm understanding this chart correctly and really comparing it to the other tax structures. We were under ELF, where we had a system where we had quite a number of fields that paid very low or zero severance tax. From 2001 to 2005, and we saw a pretty steady decline through 2005 in capital expenditures on the North Slope. We put in PPT in 06, I believe, or was it 05?
It was effective in, I believe, April 1st of 06.
Of 06. And then you had a pretty significant increase. We put in ACEs in 07, and we had increase.
That is correct,
capital
Senator
expenditures. Wilkowski. Am I reading that correctly?
That is correct, Senator Wilkowski. And again, benchmarking, part of our forecasting, we look at historical trends as well as what's happening worldwide. And again, we've got confirmation that capital costs are coming down globally. So what that tells us is if we're seeing an increase in the overall capital costs incurred on the North Slope, because the unit costs on this chart show it decreasing, this would suggest that because this is an index number that we're seeing activity as opposed to increased cost per unit.
Senator Wilkowski.
You talk here about capital costs. In the previous slide, you talked about capital expenditures.
Senator Wilkowski, those are the same.
Okay, so just to compare Alaska versus the rest of the world, the rest of the world shows a steady uptick in investment from 01 through 04, 05. We show a steady decline in our capital costs, capital expenditures. PPT ACEs, we have an increase. And then, but looking at quarter nine in particular, worldwide, there's a pretty significant decline worldwide in capital expenditures. In Alaska, we have an increase in capital expenditures. Am I reading that correctly?
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you.
And we've already covered the slide.
Yeah, uh-huh. Thank you. And this would just be an opinion. Oh. But, you know, the debate in Alaska in this building as we were going through the tax structure business was gross versus net. And retrospectively, when you look at those two debates and you take the data that you have, do you think we made a good decision going with net versus gross? I mean, we had a governor that was running on gross.
Right. Senator Huggins, through the chair, I'd say that yes, I think net has proven to be very valuable to the state.
One of the things we wanted to address in the ACES report was a unique feature of ACES as passed, and that was the standard deduction provision. And this was a provision that said that for a field that had produced a cumulative 1 billion barrels of oil to the date, the effective date of ACES, it would essentially have a authority to deduct as its operating expenses portion of lease expenditures, so the OPEX portion. It would be restricted to deducting the amount of operating expenses associated with their 2006 level of operating expenditures. It was grossed up slightly because of a difference in calendar year, fiscal year, and when the law became effective. But essentially, it was an indexed off of the 2006 operating expense rates. And the reason, as we understood it, was a fear or concern that we didn't have a lot of history on what these costs were going to be like coming out of these large fields. And since the large fields were the dog, not the tail, there was concern about what the revenue hit would be to the state because we were leaping from a gross tax structure to a net tax structure. This provision was only to be in place for 2.5 years, and it expired on December 31st, 2009. And what this slide shows is that during the half year of 2007, full year of 2008, and full year of 2009, the little orange band is the amount of additional tax that was paid by the taxpayers that had interest in Prudhoe and in Kuparik because of the difference between what the standard deduction allowed and what their actual reported operating expenses were. Now, again, the reported operating expenses have not yet been audited, so, you know, we can't verify whether those are accurate or not, but presuming that they're correct, this would be the revenue difference, the increase in the state's tax, production tax. And I'll note that even though in 2008, or fiscal year 2008, the operating expense was approximately $2.6 billion, and in 2009, the operating expense was $2.7 billion, so they were roughly equivalent, but you'll notice a big difference in the revenue impact, and that was because the overall tax rate was higher due to the much higher oil prices in 2008. So that leveraged not only the tax rate, but also the delta, or the difference for the standard deduction.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. As I recall, standard deduction was introduced on the floor sort of semi-undebated
Of the other body.
Yes, right. And then, yeah. And but my question was administration supporting standard deduction, or were you involved in that process?
The administration did not propose the standard deduction.
Were you part of the communications of standard deduction?
The standard deduction came onto the House floor, and the governor at the time was not opposed.
Thank you.
In addition, another indication of activity level is oil and gas industry employment. And we obtained these statistics from the Alaska Department of Labor. Are they called that? Department of Labor? Yeah, okay.
Workforce Development
Group. And what I'll note is that what is different about this slide from the one that shows up in the published Alaska, the ACES report, STAS report, is for 2009. In the ACES report, we stated it was an estimate because at the time that they had developed it back in January, they had not gotten in all of their data for 2009. This has been adjusted. So what I'll say is 2008, the oil and gas employment numbers were 12,900. In 2009, when we published the Alaska, the ACES status report, the number was 13,500. That was revised to 13,000 on this slide because I wanted to have the latest and best data for this body. So I learned that was 13,000. So it was an increase of 100. Between 2008 and 2009. And then in terms of the forecast from Department of Labor, their forecast is for 12,700, so they see a decrease of about 300 oil and gas jobs for 2010. And what we can see from this slide is essentially 2007, 2008, 2009, and forecasted 2010 are going to be our highest oil and gas industry employment numbers since the beginning of field development.
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you can see as you look back over this graph that the numbers bounce around quite a bit, and I just, everybody loves an anecdote as long as it involves them. So my story is, I worked a dozen years in the oil industry until 1992, and I see 1991 was, it looks like almost 11,000 jobs. The next year you drop down almost 2,000, and I don't recall 2,000 of my colleagues all going off to law school that year, but I did, and I'm just wondering, you could have, I guess, a 2,000 drop in jobs next year just on annual fluctuations. I mean, there wasn't a huge tax increase that year, there wasn't a huge startup, there wasn't a huge shutdown. How do you account for a 10% drop in jobs year to year? Is it just the nature of the industry? What can you tell us about that?
Senator French, through the chair, from the conversations we've had with the Department of Labor, Alaska's oil and gas employment is one that depends greatly on contractor groups and are on based on contracts being let for various projects. So it's very project dependent. And so you'd probably have to go back in 1991 and look and see what major project might have come to conclusion at that point in time. And when workers are let loose, they generally, it takes a little bit of time for them to be reabsorbed into other projects or other employers, other contractor employers. So it does seem to be the flow through the history of the field development.
And Marcia, we, you know, there are lots of, this is a very big focal point as well, as you know, mm-hmm. Going on, both investment itself and then employment itself and discussions about whether or not the jobs have shifted from those that are more maintenance type, mm-hmm. again, you know, retaining infrastructure as opposed to building infrastructure. So I'd love to hear a little bit on that. And then the second thing that I have heard is that unemployment rates, when mm-hmm. you file, you have to declare your category, and that for oil and gas sector jobs, there is some belief that they've gone from 1,000 in 2007 to 2,200 in 2009. And mm-hmm. so just a question about whether in your figures here you've looked at unemployment filings.
Chairman McGuire, a couple questions there, and I'm trying to remember. I'll address the last one because I do remember that one. In terms of the unemployment statistics, what we were using here were the worker comp. Let's see, it was the payroll records, which tend to be probably your most thorough and most complete because employers are required to report their payroll for purposes of being able to pay the unemployment ESC tax. In addition, we were looking at, and I believe it was the I don't know why I'm thinking worker comp, but it was another required reporting to the Department of Labor. One of the challenges we have is that the way they report, they're not required to report specifically because they're oil and gas. In other words, it has to be related to some state tax or state program that Department of Labor has jurisdiction over. So it was two of the programs. I don't believe it was the unemployment piece because unemployment tells us sort of directionally sort of how many people are off labor. And I'd heard that statistic thrown out today. What I do know is that the current rate of unemployment filed is less than it was filed in 2003. So I guess we'd have to pull up a different chart and be able to show where we stand on unemployment filings for oil and gas. But I was advised that it is no higher than it was in 2003.
Okay, and just on that point, for me, that's helpful to think about what was going on in 2003. But what I really want to understand as a policymaker, we were on a growth trajectory. We can all see that through every slide. Over these last 6 years, we've been growing the industry, growing the jobs, and I'd like to stay on that trajectory myself. And I am just curious again to carve out what's fact, what's fiction about mm-hmm. what we have done. And Bill, Senator Wilikowski makes a point, and Senator French, how do we know what impacts? I don't know, but I want to understand mm-hmm. the data as between not 2003 and now, but rather as between 2008, 9, and 10, mm-hmm. what has happened in the category of oil and gas employment, as much data as we can get, not picking one or two points again, mm-hmm. because these graphs, you know, you can pick a couple things you like or don't like, and I'm not suggesting you did that mm-hmm. at all. But I'd like to know on the unemployment filings themselves in the oil and gas field, then, just to clarify that. And then my second question, what was my second?
Let me go, I think I know what it was.
Okay.
your other question had to do with the breakdown of those jobs between maintenance and production. Mm-hmm. And I just taking a step back, I think that your line of inquiry is appropriate. What I would suggest is that we're not the ones to answer your questions because we're just the users of the information. We asked Department of Labor to provide us with the information that responded to the question that we got from legislators, which was, what's the average employment in the oil and gas sector over this period of time? We asked that question to the Department of Labor, and this is the data they gave us. There's been subsequent questions from others about sort of digging into these numbers, and frankly, we don't. You have to talk to them. And when I asked the particular question of Commissioner Bishop's statistical economist person on that maintenance question, because we were being asked that question, and I was told that they don't get the reports in such a form that they could be able to discern that. But there may be a different way to get there. But I would suggest that with regard to this new thing with regard to the unemployment insurance filings, Department of Labor is the ones to answer those questions, because we don't understand how those things are accumulated and how to interpret them. But the one thing that we can see is that the trend on employment seems to track the trends that, or the reporting that we see on expenditures pretty closely. And so what we can provide you with regard to the breakup between maintenance and non-maintenance on expenditures may be a proxy for employment as well, but I'm not exactly sure. I don't know if anybody has the answer to that.
Okay. Senator Huggins and then Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the graphing of the labor, it's interesting to me that when you go to years 2001 and you see the employment is actually lower than it was when we had the very low prices. And Senator French described in 91 how he went off to law school and the descent there. But other than that, when the prices were very low in the late 80s and early 90s, it doesn't appear to tell that picture. I'm not sure how employment, but I know that in my neck of the woods in Wasilla, you could go buy lots of houses for nothing. People give them to you. And they were vacant. And something was happening. It may not have been on the North Slope, but it appears it was a reaction to what was happening there. So I guess I'm a little suspect about the picture that this creates for us as far as what the economic status of the state was during some eras. The good news is there was an incline going into 2009. But when you look at 2003 and 4 versus back when prices were extraordinarily low, it did correlate for one reason or another.
Senator Huggins, through the chair, what's interesting is when you see this area you're talking about, this dip down here in 2003, if we go back. I never get. Wait, was I going the right way?
Yeah,
I think I was.
Backwards.
Yeah. Okay, you'll see that same dip in CapEx expenditures. It's that same shape. And so what we're seeing is the labor seems to track the CapEx spends, which could have been reflective of projects going on in that time period.
Yeah, and then, but let's go back to 91 on each side of it. You have that?
No, we definitely don't have data back there.
But you see what I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
In 91, you go, other than the drop off in 91, you say things look like, if you look at that, looks like things are going pretty well in Alaska. Mm-hmm. If you extrapolate that to the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. And it was, I don't know where I live, it was a vacant city.
Mm-hmm. Senator Wilkinson.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Moore. It would be interesting, and I think helpful for me at least, to see the comparison, the worldwide oil and gas industry employment comparisons. I read an article, Petroleum News, I think they cited a Wood Mackenzie report that said oil and gas investment was down, I think, 50% in North America as a whole, and down worldwide pretty much uniformly, except in some countries that have national oil companies, I think Brazil and Saudi Arabia. Do you have any sense of what oil and gas employment has done worldwide?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, we haven't looked at employment numbers globally. We certainly can try to find those.
It'd be helpful.
going. We also obtained information from the Alaska Oil and Gas Commission, who track drilling rigs and completions, and we were keen to see through their eyes what they were seeing. What they were able to give us, and what this is you'll see there's a line drawn through there, and that essentially represents the West Coast spot price of oil. You'll also see workover rigs are the light, what appears light gray up on the screen up there. They're blue on the handouts. And the orange color are what are called drilling rigs. So they were able to track them by specific type. And in looking at that, their conclusion was that you see a relatively flat, what they called relatively flat rig usage through this time period with what they call a drop-off in the last three quarters of 2009. And they're not sure what that drop-off represents. But it's long, it lagged, certainly, PPT and ACES enactment.
When was that chart completed?
This was completed in, we got the final data from AOGCC right at the very end of December of 2009. And actually, they were lacking, I think, their December data, as I recall, because it takes them 60 days or so to get it processed through their system, through their software system.
Yeah, thank you. We all hear the stories about how Wyoming has 30,000 wells that have been drilled and Alaska has a few hundred. Why, historically, has Alaska not had as many wells drilled as other states, Texas, Wyoming? I mean, what is there something different about Alaska? And I think we'd all agree, we all want more wells drilled. But, I mean, why historically has that not happened?
You want to take that one? I'd say it's a combination of things. Number one is probably cost, that our per well cost is significantly higher than what you'd find in Texas, Oklahoma, or Wyoming. And that the logistics of getting a well drilled in Alaska, particularly an exploration well, when you have to deal with ice roads and access issues, is a much greater undertaking than you would find outside. Secondly, the combination would include access to land. We have a significant amount of our oil and gas land locked up in existing leases, and significant expenditure to obtain a new lease and then bring up a rig and do an exploration activity. So I think it's a combination of cost and access.
And just to follow up to that, I mean, I guess I'd like, my suggestion for you would, you know, we're talking here 18 wells 1 year, 7 or 8 wells another year. I mean, this is peanuts compared to the thousands that are being done in other states, other countries. I'd like us to think bigger. I'd like us to try to figure out a way, or you to figure out a way legally, that we can really encourage smaller companies or independents or the big companies to get out there and drill not 5 or 6 more wells per year, but hundreds or dozens of more wells per year. And I don't know if that requires law changes or what, but I think, you know, we're talking, you know, looking at from 05, I mean, this is 10 wells a year. This is 10 rigs a year, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, just anecdotally, when we have talked to the new entrants, which we do because we're talking to them about how to obtain their credits and how to work through the tax system, many of them do comment on the fact that it is costly to do work in Alaska. And one of the things that they lament that they don't have here that they have down the lower 48 are roads for access. Things that they take for granted when they're doing wells in Wyoming, et cetera, is the ability to move a rig, you know, across 20 miles. And it's not a big deal down there, but it is a big deal on the North Slope. So from their perspective, where the state could most help them, what I've been hearing is, you know, improvements in infrastructure, opening up areas where they have access either through roads or some other infrastructure support. Because if it's not supplied, they have to supply it, and therefore the prospect has to be large enough to be able to justify that kind of cost for an ice road or whatever it may be.
And Senator Wilkowski, I'd respond that I think the starting point in dealing with the state trying to address these barriers is going to a system like we have now where the state is participating significantly in those upfront costs. That when we talk about cost being a significant barrier to a new entrant coming to the state, having the state pay upwards of half or more of those initial costs is a significant incentive that wasn't there previously. In addition, as Marcia noted, such things as dealing with the access issue, dealing with permitting issues, and that question of being able to get to your drill site in a relatively cost-effective manner is going to be a balance between our collective interests as it relates to, are we going to build a series of roads in otherwise undeveloped parts of Alaska with the uncertainty with regard to whether they're going to be used once for one drilling campaign and then utilized for other purposes, and all the use issues that go with that. And I think that's a question for us as a state to grapple with in terms of our commitment to seeing your goal of having more wells drilled.
Yeah, it's interesting because I agree with Senator Wilkowski, but different reasoning. But, you know, I think of, and I wrote you a letter and asked, and I know you're preparing that, so we look at other jurisdictions, particularly the Gulf Coast and some international ones. But we know that right now Alberta's upside down. They did something wrong, and we need to learn from that. And this is so healthy, the fact that we're having this discussion, and I compliment you when the House, and I wrote a letter to you at the same time supporting their actions, that you looked at it and you came back and said, yeah, there's some things that we can do. But we need to continue to dig at that because it is hugely important that we drill more wells or whatever we do to up production, and particularly in oil and gas, continue explorations. I hope we get both of them. And then, I don't know, I keep hearing that the Gulf Coast is very attractive based on what's there and what it costs to do it, but I think it's important for us to understand within the continental United States and areas that have places that are alternatives for investment, what it really means if you go to that alternative versus what we have here.
Mm-hmm. Chairman McGuire, one thing I did want to point out is, there it is. You see the run-up in the oil price, and then you see this general trend increasing in the number of rigs activity, and you'll note it sort of seems to lag by about three quarters, and then the oil price drops, and again a lag time, and you've got three quarters later where it's responding. So when we looked at that, then we reached out to see how high the correlation was between oil price and these type of expenditures, and we have found that development expenditures, which are essentially you're going to go out and you're going to get a rig and drill, seem to have a very high correlation. So that may be a partial explanation for what drives the rig activity. Obviously, other things will in terms of contract availability and demand on those rigs. Finally, wells completed from the AOGCC, what they saw was essentially a trend that was a shift in about the end of 04, beginning of 05. Again, can't really draw much of a conclusion. You're seeing PPT enacted. We note where it was enacted and where ACE isn't enacted, but from their perspective in terms of well completions, they're not seeing much of a correlation. And finally, we were asked in terms of who are the companies that are actually drilling in Alaska during the calendar year 2009. These are the companies that are actually engaging in those drilling activities that were outlined and noted by the AOGCC.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hogan.
Marcia, thank you. And if you would go back to your multicolored slide that shows the drilling rig activity, and just looking based on what you said as far as the cost, that essentially in 2010 we should see maybe not a vertical turn, but a turn to the better as far as activity based on the cost of a barrel of oil. Is that accurate?
In terms of well price, in terms of oil price, yeah. What we're forecasting a relative flat oil price going out for the coming year. What are we at, 78?
Yeah, let's call
something
it
like that. Yeah, 80, 78, whatever. 68, so
69.
68 for the rest of this year.
Right.
And
so,
then...
Yeah, so anyway, based on
so
your picture...
you would expect it to stay flat.
Flattening out. So, right. And you're not looking for any downturn based on... Because I keep hearing the different reports from mm-hmm. people that are oil service companies, and we know that ConocoPhillips mm-hmm. isn't drilling, and you would think that the line would turn down a bit. Mm-hmm. But your correlation is based on the price of oil.
Well,
be interesting to see how that works out.
It will be interesting. We're not saying this is the definitive answer, but we're looking for clues, and this might be a clue that could help us.
And Senator French. Thanks, Madam Chair. We were on the am I not seeing Exxon for a reason? I thought Exxon was drilling wells on the slope.
In 2009.
They didn't start in 2009? Kept hearing about them drilling wells.
I got these from AOGCC.
Yeah, okay.
And it could be it's not completed yet. And their statistics are strange. in a good way. I better say that. Kathy Forrester is brilliant at what she does.
Well, I guess that brings up my last point, and that is that I've been watching three intelligent, articulate members of at least one oil company waiting patiently through this presentation. I'm just wondering if we're going to hear from the industry on this general report or not. I don't know, but I'm...
So we invited them to. They wanted to hear today,
right.
And we'll...
present at a future hearing?
We will
Good.
Invite them back to tell us what they think.
Great.
But yes, we noted ExxonMobil missing as well, so
okay.
Get back to us on that. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, and thank you, Madam Chairwoman. The other one is Cook Inlet. As I recall, ConocoPhillips was obligated to do some drilling. I'm not sure in which year. Mm-hmm. And we might want to just check that and see when the activity was. Say again?
2008.
Today.
So in conclusion, the information that we were able to gather from the various state agencies as well as our tax system, what we've not been able to see a direct negative impact at this point from our tax changes. We have anecdotally heard from companies as far as what could make it better, what could improve it, what could enhance the value of the credits, et cetera, that are being offered. So we're listening and we're trying to respond to those and provide the information to help policymakers make smart choices in that regard.
Thank you both very much. So we will have you back again to augment the data as we discussed in the areas. And then we want to hear from the industry. So we'll schedule those meetings soon. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Madam Chairwoman, just my good friend Bert Stedman is not here, so I will kind of ask his question for him, maybe not as articulately as he would put it, but he is marching us through education, as you know, in Senate Finance. And one of his goals, I believe, and his spots on that research has to do with the correlation of oil and gas. And one of his concerns is that if we're going to have an open season, everybody raises their hand, locks in for 10 years, whether we lose badly based on some of the things you show there, if in fact there is a disassociation of the value between oil and gas. And I think it's important that we have that conversation because we're out of session come open season.
And Senator Huggins, through there, I agree. And that's why I look forward to participating with Senator Stedman in that that process, because I think it is something that we need to make sure that all the members are aware of, that relationship between oil and gas production and the price parity issue and what its impact could be and really what the scenarios that we could imagine could entail, and then we can assess what we each feel is the likelihood of those scenarios and weigh ways of addressing it and the problems that those ways may create, and then decide whether or not we feel we need to move before we get to the end of the session. So I look forward to working with Senator Stedman on that effort.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very much. Thank you both. We're adjourned.